I like to look back to 2008 and say, what happened in this market in 2008? Because while a lot of markets have changed considerably, the demographics have changed, employment outlook has changed, things may not be the same as 2008, but 2008 is a good baseline, a good place to start to see how bad a market got hit, because a lot of the markets that got hit in 2008 got hit for reasons that are foundationally related to how those markets are going to handle a recession. If we had another big recession, things that happened in 2008 could happen again.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Real Estate Investor MBA. My name is Tejas Gosai, and I've had the honor of helping hundreds of investors achieve the American dream by creating generational wealth through real estate. I've spent the past few years interviewing the most knowledgeable experts I could find in the business to cut your learning time and conquer the hardest subjects in the game. Check out rei.mba, which my team and I have packed with over 75 interviews and free access to our real estate roadmap, webinars, and publications. If you're listening, I am rooting for you, and you're already on your way to financial freedom. Cheers and happy hunting. It's Tejas Gosai. I get the best guests on our program. It's Real Estate Investor MBA. We have Jay Scott with us today. I've read your background. You are flourishing. I can't wait to share. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here. Appreciate you having me.
Yeah, it's kind of tough to give a synopsis about you with how much stuff you got going on, but please give us the story. Tell us how you got here and welcome.
Certainly. So I am an engineer, an MBA by education and previous career. I spent most of my corporate career in the tech industry in Silicon Valley. 2008, my wife and I decided to get married. She was in the tech industry as well. We were both working ridiculous hours. I mean, she was working 60, 70 hours a week. She was traveling 3.5 weeks a month for her job. I was probably pretty close to that. And so when we decided to get married and start a family, we knew that that wasn't the lifestyle we wanted to maintain. Long story short, we quit our jobs. We moved back to the East Coast. We fell into real estate investing. Not that interesting of a story, but it wasn't purposeful. We flipped our first house, which led to a second and a 10th and a 50th and a 400th. We were house flippers for about a decade. And then in 2018, decided to make the transition into multifamily. And since 2018, I have been a multifamily operator, syndicator, with my partner, Ashley Wilson, at Bardown Investments.
Thank you. How do we hit your website?
Anything anybody wants to learn about me, you can go to jscott.com. And that'll link you out to everywhere, including our Bardown Investments website.
Awesome. Now we got to back up a bunch. So you went through a bunch of changes, but from that 2008 period and all of that madness to COVID and now, and that's been the multifamily time, right?
Yes. 2018 till now.
Okay. Sorry. 2018. That's what I meant to say. Tell me about that. How did you start in that world? What was the first deal like? And you grew it and scaled it. That's your claim to fame. Give me the good stuff.
Yeah. So again, we did single family for about 10 years. We did many hundreds of flips. And by 2018, I was completely burned out. We've been successful in this business, I believe, because we focus on the business side of things. I'm not a real estate guy. I don't swing a hammer. I don't like to manage contractors. I don't even really like the nuts and bolts of real estate. I like the business aspects. And what I found was after 10 years that scaling a single family business is difficult. It's very much a step function scaling. And I got to the point where I just didn't want any more headaches or hassle. And so in 2018, I was about ready to leave real estate for good, go back into tech, do some consulting or some advising or sit on some boards, whatever it was going to be. But I got back all of this cash that I had been flipping with for many years. And so we were doing 10 or 15 houses at a time. And so got back a lot of cash when we sold off the bulk of our single family. And I had to decide what to do with that cash. In 2018, I was looking at the economy. I felt like we were nearing a recession. It just felt like things were getting a little bit hot. And we saw some economic indicators that indicated that things were going to soften. And so in 2018, I said, where would I want to put my money if we were heading into a recession? And I decided
what's the least risk mitigating.
Yeah. Yeah. And so what I found was in my research that multifamily real estate tended to have the best risk adjusted returns of most asset classes, certainly of any real estate asset classes up until that point. And so I thought, okay, well, multifamily is a good place to put my money, but I don't really trust other people to invest my money for me. So going in as a passive investor just wasn't interesting to me. And I said, if I'm going to put money in multifamily and I've been doing real estate for 10 years, I know the space pretty well, at least let me operate my own deals.
Be OCD about it. That's
exactly. I'm a control freak. And so I was willing to admit that I just needed to maintain control at least for a while longer, till at least I knew the industry and I knew the asset class well enough that I could vet another operator and I could vet deals and I could be comfortable handing over my money because I could do the due diligence. So I reached out to my friend Ashley Wilson, who was doing multifamily for a while up until that point. We had known each other for a while. And I basically said to her, look, I want to learn this space. Can I come work for you for a year? I'll volunteer my time, my effort, my money, my Rolodex, whatever you need.
Brilliant.
You've got me for a year. All I ask in return is let me shadow you and learn the business. And she thought it was a great deal. I thought it was a great deal. And so through 2018, 2019, I worked for her and her business. And in 2020, we realized that we had a great partnership. There were a lot of complementary skills, the things that I was really good at, she hated doing, the things she was really good at, I didn't want to do. And so we said, hey, let's partner up and make a go at this together. And so in 2020, we partnered up and bought a little over 1,000 units since then, and we're still going strong.
Wild. And bluntly, was it like January, February, March when you partnered and then COVID hit, or was it after COVID?
So we started having the conversation in late 2019. We decided in early 2020, and we actually got our first deal under contract in February of 2020, our first deal together. So it was my first multifamily deal in February of 2020. We ended up pushing that out. We closed on that deal in September after renegotiating and doing some additional due diligence, seeing where the market was headed. But yeah, it was a little scary that literally my multifamily career, for the most part, started about 3 weeks before COVID hit.
I understand, and I will share this. My partner and I, Jeff, we started our fund in 2019. We started all the paperwork, SEC stuff, and we raced to get it off the ground. It was like March 2020. And yeah, it was crazy. And so, like, you know, we paid like 100,000+ in fees, this, that. And so we ended up taking a 1 year long pause, just like, let's see what happens here. This is crazy time. We don't want to go launch some big fund and have some issues. But that's very cool that you went forward and slammed that property post COVID. How did you go from there to this many units in such a short period of time? And how big are the deals you're buying?
Yeah, in all actuality, I think we've actually scaled a little bit more slowly than a lot of groups do. Again, I was looking to invest my own capital in these deals. I was looking for a vehicle for myself. Ashley also uses these investments as a vehicle for her capital. We certainly bring in a bunch of other investors. But for us, because we're putting a significant portion of our capital in these deals, we've been very conservative. So in 2020, we did that one deal. In 2021, we did no deals. In 2022, we closed two deals. 2023, we launched a fund that purchased a couple deals. But for the most part, those are the five deals that we've done together. On average, about 200 units per deal. In reality, it's most of them are around 150, with one larger one over 400. So I know there are a lot of folks in this business that have scaled more quickly. But for us, it's not about how quickly we scale. We're very conservative, both for ourselves and for our investors.
Incredible. I love your answer. Thank you for that. And it's funny because everybody like relatively is like, you know, scaled this, that, what, you know, you don't know. I've interviewed a lot of people. That's tremendous, man. That's really like, relatively speaking, incredible. And also going into that asset class and, you know, not that soon before that. And then also launching a fund. Let's get into that. So that's a big crazy thing that happens. And we can be blunt about this. I have a lot of folks I interview. It's like you start out single family, then you go to multifamily, then you get to a place where you have to level up to get the bigger deals. Can you share that part of the journey? What made you switch? What you did?
Yeah, for us, the fund wasn't so much a graduation. It wasn't advancing to that. For us, it was more opportunistic. I come again from the tech industry. I did some M&A and some VC work. A popular asset class or investment class in the tech world or in business investing is this thing called preferred equity. And it's basically investing in a class of shares that's lower risk than typical investments. Basically, you get paid first and you have priority over the other investors in the deal. So it's lower risk because you're going to get your money back and your profits back before other investors in the deal. So 2022, I had a lot of investors who were telling me, look, we're still very interested in investing in real estate, but we're slowing down because we're concerned about the economy. We're concerned about the trajectory of the asset class. We're just waiting for the really good deals. Again, we invest our own capital. We were thinking the same thing. We were looking for something that was lower risk, or we were looking for a deal that we thought was a home run type deal. Those deals just didn't show up last year. Mm-hmm. And so instead of waiting for the great deal to come along, we decided, why not start a fund that invests in lower risk assets, specifically preferred equity? So we launched this fund that invests in this special class of shares called preferred equity, where investors can get priority over other investors in the deals. So there's more likely that they'll get their capital back. Obviously, we're not making as much in terms of returns, but it's a lot lower risk. And so that was very attractive to our investors. And so for much of the last year, we've focused on how we can grow that fund and how we can provide these better risk-adjusted returns to our investors than traditional syndications. And I think it's something that will have great opportunity for the next year or two, maybe even three. But I think as the market starts to rebound and we hit bottom and things get better, I think a lot of investors in general out there in this asset class are pretty risk tolerant. They're willing to take risks. And so I don't think that this fund in particular is going to be a long-term play for us, but I think it's the needs of our investors and Ashley and myself for today.
Brilliant. I mean, it's always good to be able to take down inventory. You use the word opportunistic. Let's talk about that. You've come a long way. Now it's this year, or I mean, let's say past 6 months and what we're looking at over the next 6 months. You're talking to investors. What are you waiting for? What are you looking at? What are you being aggressive on? What markets?
I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know where things are headed. But one of the things I like is that multifamily, for the most part, took a big hit last year between March of 2022 and August of 2022. Most of the markets that we looked at, and certainly the markets that we're in, took a 25 or 30% hit on values. Cap rates went up, NOIs dropped a little bit, vacancies increased. We saw a big hit for that first 4, 5, 6 months after interest rates started to rise. The interesting thing is, since August or September of 2022, we haven't seen much of a movement in values in the multifamily space. Now, some of that is there's been such low transaction volume, it's hard to get any price discovery because we don't see a lot of transactions. Another part of that is that we just haven't seen a big drop in the market since last year. Most of the big drop happened right after interest rates started to climb. Things started to stabilize. So that gives me some reason to believe that even if we're not at a bottom of the market, we're well off the top and we're probably a lot closer to the bottom than we are to the top, which gives me the confidence to go into some deals, even if they're not home run deals, knowing that we have some likely downside risk aversion or mitigation simply because we're probably closer to the bottom than the top. And if we can keep cash flow steady and not have to worry about running into any issues with the banks or our investors for the next year or two, I'm comfortable that we'll start to hit the other side of the curve and things will start to go back up.
Are you analyzing a bunch? Are you still looking at a bunch of deals? How's that pipeline going for you?
Yeah, we've seen a whole lot more deals come through our pipeline in the last 3 months than we had in the previous 18 months. So that's promising. A lot of those deals, they're still not penciling, but they're closer. We like to make offers on every deal that comes into our pipeline, even if we're off by 20, 30, 40% of list price or whisper price. So we make a lot of offers. We were off $5 or $10 million on some deals last summer. Now we're still off by $1 million or $2 million. So that means either the sellers are getting more reasonable or demand is dropping, or maybe there's some just coming together of supply and demand. But it's certainly looking like we're getting back to a market that's a little bit more efficient and there's going to be opportunities in the near future.
I like that. I'm also just hungry for deals. When you say the word penciling, let's say I don't know what that means. Tell me about what that means for you guys.
The market, our investors, are demanding some level of return. And so when we analyze a deal, the first thing we need to do is we need to see if our investors can get the return that they are going to need in order to take the risk of investing with us. And obviously, we want to make sure that it's reasonable that they're actually going to achieve those returns, because we could do 20 deals this year. It doesn't mean they're all going to go well. And if the deals don't go well, our investors aren't going to come back. So we need to be comfortable that these deals can generate the returns our investors want them to generate. And then at the same time, after our investors get the return, we need to make sure that we're generating enough profit on our side that it makes the deal worth it. I've seen a number of operators over the last year and a half that I believe are doing deals that work for their investors, but are very thin for themselves as operators. And while that's noble of them to do those deals if they're trying to keep their investors' money working, the concern I would have is that if an operator isn't necessarily going to make much money on a deal, If things start to get tough, what incentive do they have, or how much incentive do they have to focus a lot of their time on that deal versus a new deal that might have a lot more profit potential? It really needs to be, when I say pencil, I mean underwrite the deal, analyze the deal, and ensure that it's very much a win-win for both our investors and ourselves.
Brilliant. What exact markets? You said 250 units per deal type?
Yeah, we average probably about 200 units per deal. Historically, Houston has been our major market. Most of our units are in Houston. We have seen some turning tides in Houston over the last couple of years. Houston took a really big hit with evictions, and there's about an 80,000 tenant pipeline for evictions in Houston. And so it's taking a very long time relative to how long it used to take to evict tenants. So we're racking up bad debt on a lot of our properties. Insurance costs with the hurricanes that we've seen over the last couple of years and the weather changes, insurance costs have gone through the roof in Houston. And so units that we were spending $800 or $900 per unit on insurance are up to $1,500, $1,600, $1,800 per unit on insurance now. And so that's requiring us to operate more efficiently and to really know our numbers well. And luckily, we got in with some really good debt terms on these deals. But we've seen struggles in Houston, like everybody that's in that market. And so we're starting to look at other markets because we're not convinced that the insurance situation is going to rectify itself in the near future. So we really like the Southeast, North Carolina, South Carolina, good population growth, good employment growth, still very reasonable pricing.
When you say we're looking, does that mean you're looking and you're analyzing and you're like about to go attack that market?
Yes. So my team is very much looking in a bunch of markets in North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Tennessee. The Southeast are the markets that we really like right now.
Yeah, by land, by air, by sea. If you got to go to where the deal is, you're going to want scalability there, at least like efficiency and taking over a bunch of properties in one area.
Yeah. Right? And what a lot of people who are new to this business don't realize is, unfortunately, it's not as easy as saying, hey, there's a market, let's go attack it. And you get a deal in a month or two or three. A lot of times for these size deals, they're being controlled by brokers. And some handful of brokers are basically dealing with these large properties. And it can take time to build relationships with those brokers and convince those brokers that, one, you're serious, you can close, and that they should be working with you over other buyers in the market. And those relationships can take months or even years to build. I mean, we spent a half decade building those relationships in Houston, and we're starting over in these other markets. So it is very much a long-term commitment every time you move into another market when you're doing deals of this size.
That's great. Even property management companies and the local municipality, yeah, like eviction stuff matters then, and things you don't want to think about.
Absolutely.
What are some of the indicators or specific best indicators that you use to look at these?
When we're looking at a market, the three big ones that I think a lot of people in the industry look at are population growth, employment growth, and wage growth. Your customer is the tenant for the most part. You want to see that you have more customers moving into the area. You want to see that those customers are employed and have good jobs, and you want to see that their wages are going up faster than inflation. So the big three that we look for are population growth, employment growth, and wage growth. For me, a big one is employment diversity. I want to see that there are a lot of different industries in a market, because I remember 2008. I was investing through 2008, and I've studied a lot of economic history, and I recognized that during a downturn, a lot of times it's one or two or three industries that can get hit hard. So if you look back at 2008, the places that got hit the hardest, Orlando, Las Vegas, LA, places that are high tourist areas because people weren't spending money on tourism. And so if you were investing in a market that relied on tourism, you were probably struggling during 2008 if you were a property owner. So I'd like to see that there are a number of different industries that make up the backbone of a market, so that if any industry takes a big hit or any one company takes a big hit. I worked for Microsoft for a really long time. And so I know that pre-2008, 2007, investing in Seattle, if for some reason something happened to Microsoft, you could lose a whole lot of tenants overnight. Now, that market's changed in the last 15 years, but there are a lot of markets. I mean, if you invested in Detroit in the late 80s, early 90s, the car industries, you took a big hit when there was a lot of layoffs in the car industry. You have to be careful with employment diversity, and we like to see areas that have a lot of that. I like to look back to 2008 and say, what happened in this market in 2008? Because while a lot of markets have changed considerably, the demographics have changed, employment outlook has changed, Things may not be the same as 2008, but 2008 is a good baseline, a good place to start to see how bad a market got hit, because a lot of the markets that got hit in 2008 got hit for reasons that are foundationally related to how those markets are going to handle a recession. If we had another big recession, things that happened in 2008 could happen again.
I love it. Let me bring up something cool before we run out of time, and I think you'll agree. It's actually been neat to see how the Fed has dealt with inflation and all this stuff over the past few months. This is the first time in history that it was like, let's go. You know, we're not going to let anything happen, but like, God, it's a blessing. So many folks don't realize how good this is. You want to talk about that before we got to go?
Yeah. So it's been a tough year and a half for a lot of people. I did write a book on economics related to real estate.
Please share that.
It's actually what's right there, that book. Nice. Called Recession Proof Real Estate Investing. It's an economics book, but specifically geared towards real estate investors to understand market cycles and how market cycles work and how they can leverage knowledge of those cycles to improve their businesses. The last year and a half has been interesting. A lot of people believe that the Fed tightened too quickly, they raised rates too quickly. It's a hard job. It's a really hard job, and everybody's a Monday morning quarterback. It looks like they did things correctly this time. I'm not sure if they did that on purpose or if they kind of just backed into it, but I suspect typically we see a lag in tightening of the financial markets, whether it's interest rates or the Fed selling off their books. Typically, we see a lag of 6 to 9 months between when they take action and when it actually hits the market, and we were tightening up until just a few months ago. And so it's very possible that a lot of that tightening from a few months ago could still be working its way through the system. So I suspect that they've overcorrected a little bit. I suspect that they suspect they've overcorrected a little bit.
Has to be on purpose.
Yeah. And they're signaling now that they're willing to drop rates or to put more onto their balance sheet if things start to turn and soften in the market. So I think that's the right move.
I'll add to what you're saying. This is historic low still.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm in my 40s, but like there's some people, my mentees, and they're like, oh my God. And I'm like, dude, like look at a history book.
My first bank account, my first savings account, I was getting 18% interest. And so
What year was that?
It was in the 80s. I was a teenager. So I'm in my early 50s. And so, yeah, I remember I wasn't obviously buying houses back then, but I remember those crazy interest rate days.
And people were buying houses. People were building businesses at 25, 30%. It's crazy.
Yeah. So I suspect that we'll have a softening over the next couple months. I suspect that the Fed will react appropriately. And I think we can avoid anything major for this year, especially it's an election year. So both sides would be pulling out all the stops to avoid anything major. And I expect a pretty uneventful year, economically speaking.
That's actually nice to hear. And that is the crystal ball stuff I usually ask for. You know, you didn't say anything that is like unreasonable or risky, which I love it. You have a great book and open book, and the way that you share and present everything, I would invest in you. How does someone invest in you or get a hold of you?
Well, if anybody wants to connect with me, reach out. I'm pretty easy to get a hold of. Go to jscott.com, and that'll link you out to everything you might want to.
And I'm interested in this book that you just pumped out. That's very cool. How do we get a hold of that?
So again, jscott.com, there's a link there to see all my books. I've written 5 books. And if anybody follows me on Facebook, I do a lot of long form writing on the economy. I have a newsletter that goes out once a week, long form on the economy. I'll mention we have a podcast. I do a podcast called Drunk Real Estate with 3 other co-hosts. One of my business partners, Mauricio Raoul, who is a well-known syndications attorney in the space, and AJ Osborne, who owns about $500 million in self-storage. And we get together once a week and we just opine on economics and real estate markets and anything related to investing. And so check out Drunk Real Estate, the Drunk Real Estate podcast.
Are you guys drinking at that time?
We do. We all bring a drink. Sometimes if we get an hour, hour and a half into the show, it gets more interesting. But yeah, we do.
That's awesome. Well, listen, thanks for making it here. Beautiful interview. Great work you've done.
Hey, I appreciate it so much. Thanks so much for having me.
For sure. That's Jay Scott. This is Real Estate Investor MBA. I'm Tejas Gosai. Check out our website, rei.mba. Cheers.